eroded soft sediments that had buried the Rockies began to get stripped away by the rivers, and in only a few million years, the Rockies were again revealed to the air as the present-day mountains which we see today. So the reason that those mountains look so fresh and young is not just that they formed recently. Water erosion is such a potent force on this planet that even as recently as 65 million years ago, if they had formed then and been exposed to that erosion ever since, the Rockies would be gone. As it is, much more material has been eroded off them already than is left in them today. Where is that material? The Great Plains is where much of it is. That is a sheet of sediments laid down for almost 1,000 miles to the east of the Rocky Mountains, sediments eroded off them. And where is the rest of them? The Gulf Coast Plain. Texas, Louisiana, material deposited at the edge of the continent by the rivers that made it all the way to the sea, and there are places where those sediments extend inland for 125 miles and have a vertical thickness of 80,000 feet. That's where the Rockies went. What is left of them now is mostly core, preserved for us by the fact that they have been buried under sediment throughout most of their history. Now, I said a pyrogenic uplift is gentle. It's as though you and I pick up opposite edges of a card table. Locally, though, here and there, there is faulting, and even sometimes minor folding, although in the case of the Rockies, almost none. 9 million years ago, when the Rockies were uplifted, there were some ranges where faults developed on either side, and those ranges got thrust up particularly high. Those are the most spectacular ranges in the Rockies today. The Tetons are the classic example. You go to Grand Teton National Park, and you will find that the mountains have a profile that they are very steep on the east edge, gently sloping like so on the west edge, and then to the east of them there is a valley called Jackson Hole. The park consists of much of the mountain range, the rest being in the national forest, and of Jackson Hole. Well, when the Tetons, the east face of the Tetons is roughly the Teton Fault. There's been erosion since they got uplifted, but it's roughly the trace of the Teton Fault. That's at an angle, of course, and the Tetons got shoved up on the one side, and on the other side there was a pyrogenic downwarp, and so you have a total difference in the vertical location of a given stratum, that is where that stratum might be if it were still up there in the air above the present-day Tetons, all the way down to where that stratum is buried deep under the recent sediments that now line the floor of Jackson Hole, because as soon as it gets downwarped, it starts filling in with sediments, right? Okay. Total vertical displacement of 7 miles. I don't mean by that the Tetons were ever 7 miles high and then got eroded down, but I mean that the two motions along the trace of that fault kept going until there was and erosion kept pace with them and deposition in the valley, until there was a total displacement, vertical displacement of 7 miles. It's still happening a little bit. The Grand Teton is now, 40 inches higher than it was at the beginning of the century. So there is still a little bit of motion along the Teton Fault. So that's the reason why the Rockies show some really spectacular and very, very young-looking ranges, sharp, jagged, like the Tetons, the Uintas, the other major ranges in the Rockies. Those ranges are only 9 million years old, at least as big high mountains, whereas the others are 65 million years old and have been much more eroded, much more rounded off. So that's the coda. Okay, from this point on, I have nothing more to say, but if you have questions, I will be happy to answer them until we get kicked out.
Going back to the Appalachians for a minute.
Yeah.
Are there green mountains?
Oh, I got to tell you, that's just triggered the memory of my favorite statistic about the Appalachians, to tell you how much they've been eroded and what a pyrogenic uplift can do for you, too. One reason the Rockies are so high above sea level is that even their base is a mile above sea level as a result of the pyrogenic uplift. You know, Denver is a mile-high city, not because it's up in the mountains. It's at the edge of the Great Plains. My favorite statistic is there is no point in Grand Teton National Park, including the lowest spot on the bottom of Jackson Lake, that is as low as the highest point in the Appalachians. The highest point in the Appalachians is Mount Mitchell in North Carolina. I'm sorry, you were trying to say.
Yeah, what about the Green Mountains? Were they part of the original Appalachians?
Yeah, the Green Mountains, yes. New England was part of the original Appalachians, and you'll learn much more about that next time. That's where I'll go into the detailed structure of the Appalachians. You may think I told you the whole story now. You'd be amazed how much I've left out people. Whole concepts, not just details of the history. The whole concepts about the structure of the Appalachians. You ain't seen nothing yet.
Is that next week?
No, 2 weeks from today.
Would you say a mountain is the Alps are young mountains?
The Alps are semi-young mountains. They have had a much more complex history in detail than I led on when I just said they were caused by Italy getting jammed up into Europe by Africa. The Alps are the most complex mountain range on Earth. In fact, geology was, as far as understanding of mountain origin was concerned, geology was at a standstill for a century between the beginning of the science and the time when we finally were able to study the Appalachians, because all they had were the Alps, and it was the worst possible place to go to kindergarten. You know, nobody could make any head or tail of the Alps. Even now, a lot of the details are not understood. They have a horribly complicated history. Mount McKinley is part of the Rocky system, and that is relatively young, yes.
How does that mid-continent earthquake compare with the Alaskan earthquake of the 1960s and Chinese?
Bigger than either.
How large?
The question was, how does the New Madrid earthquake compare with the recent Peking earthquake and the 1960 Alaskan earthquake, 1960s Alaska earthquake, and the answer is bigger than either. By, you know, a Richter magnitude or so. But you got to remember, every Richter magnitude is 10 times as much energy as the one before. You know, so difference of one Richter magnitude is quite a lot.
The Alaskan earthquake
was large. The Alaskan earthquake was large, yes, but the New Madrid was even larger. If that had been a populated area, it would have been one of the worst disasters in Earth history. The worst earthquake toll in history was in China. It was 800,000 people. But that was because the earthquake broke dikes and flooded hundreds and hundreds of square miles of richly populated area. So, in fact, that's usually the case in a really severe earthquake toll. It's not the earthquake itself that gets you, it's the secondary effect. For that matter, that's true even if you're in, say, the San Francisco earthquake in 1900, whenever it was. Nobody was ever killed by the shaking of the ground. You know, that's not that severe, unless you die of fright because you have a heart attack. But what you get killed by is bricks falling from the tops of collapsing buildings and that kind of thing. You know, what? I can't hear you. In a nuclear explosion, most people are killed by falling bricks? Really? Okay, I assume it was the radiation. Amazing. Okay.
Like in a tornado, they have, you know, flying objects.
Sure. Okay, any other questions about geology? Okay, then thank you very much for your interest, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.
I got a question for geology.
Okay.
It's timely enough, so it should be asked.
All right.
Funds, original funds for Viking runoff, May 78. Is there anything?
March 78.
March
1st, 78 is when they're scheduled to be turned off.
Okay. Has it been turned off?
Not 78, 79.
Oh, 79. March, yeah. 79. Okay, yeah. Then they've been extended a little bit from the original date.
Depends on what you mean by original, but for quite some time there has been Viking funding
for...
No, I think I was saying May of next year. Was it saying May?
Yeah, you're saying May 78.
Okay, March 1st, 79 is the date that they're now citing.
Okay, good.
600,000 years ago in what is now Yellowstone National Park that produced an explosion crater 40 miles in diameter. It occupies most of the park, but it wasn't discovered until the 1950s because it filled in later with gentler lava flows. And it produced a sheet of red-hot volcanic ash mixed with gases, which traveled at a speed of perhaps 200 miles an hour and covered the entire state of Wyoming and over into western South Dakota on one side and well into Oregon on the other side. That kind of thing is called a nuée ardente. And you can still see the remnants of that sheet of volcanic ash. The gas very quickly escapes from it, and the ash means small solid particles of volcanic material, and it settles down, and since it's still red hot, it welds itself together. Such a rock is called a welded tuff. And I could take you over to a place in Idaho just outside Yellowstone where there is a road cut through a bed of welded tuff that is 300 feet high. After settle.
Like
so, compared to Krakatoa, that's, you know, compared to that, Krakatoa is nothing.
Well, you were saying...
I mean, can you imagine what it would be like to have something like that bearing down on you at 200 miles an hour?
Yeah, you mentioned that, 200
you can?
Miles an hour.
Yeah.
The last time you used a figure like that for speed of materials in mass was these oceanic landslides, is the best word I can come up with for
uh-huh.
them. When I looked at a picture of Beauty on Mars, and that wonderful ejecta blanket.
Yes.
And which was caused by permafrost, rapid melting of the permafrost during the impact.
Yeah, let's say rapid evaporation.
Would that have moved out from UT at those kind of speeds? Being lubricated by the meltwater?
Yeah. I don't know if I've ever heard an estimate of speed of travel of a crater ejecta blanket, but I can't imagine that it's not at least that kind of speed.
Stuff being evacuated from the center of the crater move at supersonic speed.
There are a lot of things that we don't understand about large-scale motion of granular land, so to speak, broken up on sediment. For example, there are landslides which you can trace, they go as coherent units down one side of a valley and crawl halfway up or a third of the way up the other side. And the story used to be they're lubricated by trapped air, which can't get out of the way because they fall so fast. But on the moon, there's a landslide exactly like that at the Taurus Littrow Apollo 17 site. And we know that wasn't lubricated by trapped air. And it was not caused by, that's not part of an ejecta blanket. It was apparently caused, it's off the side of South Massif, the big mountain just to the south of the Apollo 17 site, which they drove over to. And apparently what happened was when the crater Tycho formed 200 million years ago, a blob of ejecta from Tycho traveled the 1,300 miles from Tycho to South Massif, slammed into the other side of South Massif, and as a result of the shaking of the mountain, knocked this landslide down the north side. And, it was not lubricated by air, obviously. There's no air on the moon. So it's plain that there are some things that we just don't understand. Other people with questions?
Yeah. I thought that Arizona meteor was large, but after you mentioned it, another two.
Sure. Look, the Imbrian Basin is 800 miles across on the moon.
No. Down to Parks Pavilion, there isn't it.
The
if you go to Borough Park Pavilion, I don't know what happened to Parks Pavilion.
Can't hear you. Yeah, Death Valley is one of the downwarp sections in the basin and range province, one of the basins. How deep is the bedrock floor of Death Valley? By bedrock, you don't mean bedrock. You mean how deep is the floor below the recent sediments. I just don't remember. I have the impression it's a few miles. But it's, if somebody told me that it's a comparable sort of thing to the Tetons and Jackson Hole, which really is a comparable structure, although it's not in the Basin Range Province, wouldn't surprise me terribly. I'd have to look that up, but I don't know it offhand. Yeah, I realize there are an awful lot of basins and an awful lot of ranges out there.
I have a fragment of that Arizona.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, you too.
Before the summer's out, my dad's going out there to visit, and I'm going to give him little vials to take samples at different distances to the crater, so
uh-huh.
I can test them when he gets back.
Uh-huh. Are you going to study them a vial? Are you going to study them a vial?
Yeah.
The meteorite is not buried. There is no meteorite.
No.
It vaporizes when it hits.
Well, I mean, this is so large that they have tested the ground there, and they get so deep, and they've tried picking. Some have tried, but they've given up because of the cost.
They've given up because it was finally realized from the physics of meteorite impact that there's not going to be a meteorite down there. But they didn't know that around 1910 or so when the Barringer Mining Company started digging. And he thought there was going to be a big mass of nickel iron down there, which would be commercially exploitable. Well, he was wrong. I mean, the reasonable sort of thing to think in view of what they knew at the time.
It
vaporized when it hit. The friction of the impact is so severe that the meteorite vaporized.
They said if it flew during the day there above the Earth, it would be brighter than the sun. Well, I suppose in that
certainly
locality,
sounds
maybe.
Reasonable, yeah.
Yeah.
How many billion Hiroshima? Well,
sure.
Not that one.
No, that one. That was a few Hiroshima bombs.
Yeah, I mean,
but that's
in that area, it was lighter.
Yeah,
sure.
That's reasonable. Yeah.
Is it the friction? I was under the assumption that it was just the kinetic energy that moves you. You're stopping this.
Same difference. You're expressing it one way, I'm expressing it another way.
You're stopping the thing moving at something around 44 miles per second.
All right. By what mechanism is the kinetic energy converted into thermal energy?
I was under the impression it wasn't thermal energy so much. It was like a sublimation almost.
Well, yeah, but it gets heated to the point where it vaporizes, right?
Because
if you cut the thing in half, it's working out.
Can't hear you. Still can't hear you. Sorry, there's too much noise. There is some evidence that the Mediterranean dried up several times, yeah.
Megadeth.
Yeah, sure.
Megadeth.
Oh, that would have been tremendous. Okay, well, this seems like a reasonable place to kill it. For one thing, it's almost 11 o'clock. And I think it's 11 o'clock that you kicked out, isn't it?
11:30.
Something like that. Well, in any case, the reason is a good excuse. So, hope to see you in 2 weeks.
You are an NPR.
Well, I admit I haven't been on ATC for a long time. But
I'll see.
Well, ready to protest. I've been trying to get in touch with Rick Lewis, who just took over as the producer from Dave Prey. Yeah, well... I know what you mean, but on the other hand, he does a remarkably good job considering the impossibility of the assignment. Right.
Cover everything in science.
Exactly. You know, I realize that's praising with faint dams or something, but it's... I semi-admire Ira.
Okay, on last week, with reference to Manilplume.
When I am on NPR, it's often in the morning news, but you don't get to hear that on the stations around here.
None I guess not. I've never heard of it at all.
Yeah, there is a morning news program. There's a 5-minute news program and then a 10-minute thing called Closer Look, which is a sort of mini ATC.
But I haven't heard you.
Well, you certainly don't hear me on every day or anything like that.
Well,
but,
not the ones I've listened to either. And, my luck, I guess.
Well, where do you mean you have a station where you can hear it?
Yes, Central Michigan University.
Oh,
WCMU.
Okay. Yeah, I can't hear that. Okay. I can hear four NPR stations, and not one of them carries it.
With reference to Manilplume, did the geographic poles remain stationary? I know the magnetic
That is a very controversial question, and I think and has been for a long time. In fact, it's a separate question from plate tectonics or continental drift, obviously.
Yeah.
And some people try to use the idea of polar wandering to explain what we now explain by continental drift, and it doesn't work, because if you try to plot the position of the pole using magnetic data from different continents at the same time, you get different positions for the poles. And in fact, that's how you can plot the wanderings of the continents, you know, seeing how you got to move them to make the positions of the poles merge. So the modern form of the question is, given that we pretty well established that the continents do move around, in addition, is there anything that you can't explain with that in the observations that you need to invoke polar wandering for too? And I think the general answer to that, at least at the moment, is no, there is not. There is no need for polar wandering. But, you know, stay tuned for a latest bulletin.
Does tectonics have anything to do with explaining the flipping of magnetic poles? I think you already answered that with...
Nobody has any idea what even caused the Earth's magnetism, let alone what causes it to flip.
Does the Lake Huron basalt, if you go up around Fort Huron, you find the beaches littered with it. Is that from that?
That's shale.
Is it really?
I'm pretty sure, if you're talking about the same beach I am.
Okay, Lake Fort.
Come to think of it, I'm sorry, I take that back. That was over on the other side of the lake. But
that's Kettle Point there. Out around Kettle Point, things where they got the shale.
I can't remember where we went. It was too many years ago. But to the best of my knowledge, there are no basalt outcrops on the edge of Lake Huron. You got to go to the Keweenaw Peninsula.
Area, if it could have come down,
you know, anywhere in Michigan that you dig into the glacial drift, you'll find chunks of basalt that have been carried down from the north, Keweenaw or elsewhere. In fact, in our area, it would be elsewhere. But I find it hard to believe that there are any places where so much of it has been left that there's actually a beach of it. You know, you're talking about an outcrop of bedrock.
No, I'm talking about small chunks of this stuff over the beach.
Hmm.
My parents and I used to go out there and pick bushel baskets full of them, take it back and put it in the rock garden in the house.
Uh-huh. You grew rocks? Remarkable.
Yeah. Bushes of them.
I see. All right.
The little ones are rockets. The 2-mile high waterfall must have been created when Gibraltar reopened.
Yes.
Okay, you've got the hellish temperatures at the bottom of this chasm.
Yeah.
You've got the water spilling over the edge, temperature above 212 at the bottom. The water never makes it to the bottom, right?
No, the temperature probably wasn't 212 all over the bottom, just in the deep areas in the Mediterranean basin.
I had beautiful visions of just this thing falling off the edge and turning to clouds. You know?
Yeah.
That would have profound effects, something like that, on the local weather.
Sure. I don't know enough. Well, would it? I wonder if the sea might not recondense again by the time it reached the top.
constantly rain in this valley.
Yeah, but so far as I know, I just don't know enough, and I don't know whether anybody has done any detailed studies of what the temperature would have been, you know, as a function of geographic location down there. So I can't absolutely rule it out, but I never heard anybody talk about it.
One last one. In the Sky Telescope, August 73, the report on the Lunar Science Conference, Rice University, some researchers discovered the moon is charged on the day side with a plus charge of 10 volts. On the night side, it has a minus charge of 100 volts. What is the significance of this kind of charge orbiting in the Earth's magnetic field? Although, albeit our field isn't real strong out there. But what can we get a Jupiter-type effect, a Jovian-type effect out of it?
Well, we clearly don't. So, I've just never heard anybody address the question, but you know, the potential across Io is 20 kilovolts.
Yeah.
You're talking about a potential of 110 volts.
I thought maybe we might be able to observe something on a smaller scale.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll put it on my mental list of things to ask Jim Warwick next time I talk to him. But I think the answer is no.
You know, you did something again last week. Remember, I hit you with the question about the 20-mile deep sediment you mentioned once.
Yeah, and I said 20,000 feet. I know.
You said 80,000 feet for one last week. Once I wrote it down.
80,000. Yeah, 80,000 is the correct number, I think.
How do you mean that? I don't think I understand how you mean that, because 80,000 is over 7 miles.
Sure, the number I've seen is 80,000 feet.
Does this mean 80,000 total? Once you, if you piled on and you wrote it,
that's what he did say. Now I'm
like
directly,
the Tetons with their total displacement.
Interesting thought. Very interesting thought.
Because they should just squish themselves right into some sort of...
By the way, I know where you got that 20-mile figure, because I was embarrassed to run into it during the week. It's in one of the Viking notes, and it's just plain wrong.
Okay.
And that's where you got it, I think.
Yeah,
or
it was
else.
Your Cranbrook Viking lecture. Because, like I said, I've been knowing all the...
I don't know. We've either proved one of two things. Number one, I don't remember the number correctly, or number two, it's what you say, and I just didn't... I remember exactly where I got that, and I remember the guy saying it, and I've just been quoting it ever since. It's plagiarized directly from Bruce Wilkinson, who's a sedimentary geologist.
The reason I'm so interested in it is...
maybe I just never thought about it much, or enough.
Because I've been wondering, is it possible in tectonics for a mountain range to come up so fast that it can't actually get higher than 7 miles for a small period of time? But I guess we've had no crumple mountain ranges that have reached like...
Oh, now most of those sediments are below sea level just because they do sink under their own weight. That much I can tell you.
That's what would happen, the land would just...
Oh yeah, yeah, sure. Well, for example, the Mississippi Valley embayment, which is full of all that material deposited by the Mississippi River and others, is still sinking, and that's what caused the New Madrid earthquake, for example. And that's still a seismic area, and you know, someday there's going to be another New Madrid earthquake, maybe not as big, but in that area we expect another earthquake to
deploy. How much Meyer?
Comet Meyer? Have you heard anything less about Comet Meyer?
All I have is data on the CIAU report in the last one, the published paper.
Okay.
There were a total of 2 observations.
Okay.
That's all I know. Right now, it's 9.5 to 10 magnitude of the length. No, I couldn't find it.
Did you tell him about your Jordan Marston?
Okay, I got 2 observations. I wanted to produce my own ephemera. What did I do? Invent a third position. Right in line with the first two, the same as Mars.
Okay.
Got elements for it. So I got a parabolic
sweep of you here. It does turn you over in the brain.
I got a sweep of you here.
All right. Yeah, I think we've just... okay, you're pointing, stop spinning.
What else can I do? Is it zero to order approximation?
Well,
I have 2 data points I want.
Why don't you just make up the data out of whole cloth? I mean, if people are reliable, it's much easier.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, man, the astrologers do it and make fortunes.
I welcome you all to this wettest of all planets, or weirdest of all planets, whichever it is, the last in our series of talks for this school year. Jim Lowden, commentator on Space and Astronomy for National Public Radio. Starting off on a continuing, I guess, the pace of what he started last time, but what could be another whole series of talks, the Skylab Tour of the United States. He will not cover all of it in one gasket. We'll just start in the eastern part of the United States.
Thank you much. As a matter of fact, not cover it all in one gasp, and it could be a series, count as the greatest understatements I have heard in the past several months. This is about the Appalachians pretty much exclusively, and as a matter of fact, mostly about the Appalachians south of New England. And if you think I can't get an evening's lecture out of that, you little know your man. There is indeed a lot to say. This is a follow-on to last time's lecture, the one that was 2 weeks ago, called Earth, the Weirdest Planet of All, Part 1, Plate Tectonics, or actually we called it Continental Drift because we figured nobody would know what plate tectonics meant. However, for those of you who were not at that lecture, fear not, it should be independently understandable tonight. I'm not going to reproduce what I said last time, duplicate what I said last time, but I'll try to make it independently understandable. I'd be interested, though, just out of morbid curiosity, how many of you were at that last lecture, just so I have some feeling for the audience. Okay, it looks like about half and half, doesn't it? All right, well, that's fine. So those of you who would like more information, if we get turned on tonight and decide they would be interested in more, I strongly recommend that you do come back 2 weeks ago, because I said all kinds of things then. And there could indeed be lots and lots more of Skylab Tour of the United States, Part 87, Part 88, so forth and so on. Before we get started, it's been suggested that I point out to you that the next launch in our planetary exploration, which is Pioneer Venus Orbiter, they may call it Pioneer Venus 1, they may call it Pioneer 12, I don't know what they're going to call it, I don't think they know yet what they're going to call it, but by whatever name, the first of two launches in this mission to explore the atmosphere of Venus. In fact, the first planetary mission in history devoted primarily to the atmosphere as opposed to the surface and interior. In other words, the meteorology primarily as opposed to the geology primarily of another planet is starting a week from Saturday. That is May 20th. That's the nominal launch date. If anything goes wrong at the last minute, and very often that happens with planetary missions, then they can put it off until as late as June 2nd and still not hurt the mission any. And then in August, and again the nominal date is August 4th, and they could put it off until pretty much any time through the rest of the month, is the launch of the other spacecraft, Pioneer Venus Multiprobe, which is the one that will get the greatest amount of attention. The orbiter, as the name implies, will go into orbit around Venus, send us back pictures and many other kinds of data. But the multiprobes will enter the atmosphere, descend through the atmosphere, four probes altogether, plus in the upper part of the trajectory, the bus, which launches them, that is the main spacecraft, the one that cares for them on the way to the planet. And during about 1 hour, the probes will descend through the atmosphere, radio back all kinds of data as they go, and crash onto the surface. They are not designed to survive the landing. This is an atmospheric mission. We're not interested in the surface. In fact, there's a good chance that it would, I mean, we are interested in the surface, but that's for another mission. I don't want to give the impression when I say this is the first atmospheric mission, the others have been geological, that I'm trying to say one is more important, the other is less important. They're both important. This happens to be the first time that we've done the one, and previously we and the Russians have done the other, to some extent anyway. I've given lectures about Venus in this series, so I'm not going to repeat those. However, if you are interested in information about Pioneer Venus, which, number one, you don't know if you didn't hear those lectures, but also, number two, you don't know even if you did, because I did not talk a whole lot about the mission itself, how it is going to operate, what kinds of data we're going to get, how you justify the statement that we are going to learn more about Venus in that 1 hour than we have in all the centuries up till now. If you are interested enough in it to come to Ann Arbor, then on Friday, June 2nd, I'm going to give a lecture about the Pioneer Venus mission, and virtually everything that I say there will not have been included in the two Venus lectures that I gave in this series earlier in the year. That lecture and a number of other ones and a number of events that I'm not doing that have to do with astronomy that other people are doing at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor are all listed on this white mimeograph sheet, and you're most welcome to come up and take a copy of it. In fact, or take several if you've got friends that you think might be interested. If you're interested in something else, the next event will at Ann Arbor, in fact, will be tomorrow night, Friday night, and there will be two films about the sun, including one from Skylab. So you'll get some Skylab Earth results tonight. If you're interested in Skylab sun results, come to Ann Arbor tomorrow night, and all the information, including driving directions, are right here.
and you'll see that film, another film about the sun, and then a lecture that I'm going to give about a very, very magnificent, beautiful, spectacular event, namely a total eclipse of the sun, which is going to happen next year. This will be the last total eclipse of the sun visible from the contiguous United States in this century. In fact, until the year 2017. It'll be visible from a strip across the Pacific Northwest and up into central Canada. As a matter of fact, a lot of people from this area will probably go to Canada instead of the U.S. You must know a great deal in order to be able to see it. It's not enough to be casually aware there's going to be an eclipse somewhere sometime. You've got to know exactly where to go, where the best weather conditions are, where the longest duration of totality is, and so forth. And you also have to know what to do in order to look at it safely. It is safe to look at if you know what you're doing, but most people don't. And if, for example, if you try to look through smoked glass, you are more likely to blind yourself than if you use nothing at all. And you are quite likely to do it if you use nothing at all. So if you're interested in all those things, and you may very well be, and if you think you're not, a total eclipse is just one of the most magnificent sights that nature has to offer. And you don't have any impression of what it's like if you've seen photographs, if you've seen them on television, if you've seen movies, and of course if you've seen a partial eclipse, that's absolutely nothing whatsoever. That's like the difference between reading about having a $1 million a year job and actually having it. You know, there's just no comparison whatever. And this is your last chance in the contiguous U.S. in this century until 2017, and by then there will be so much air pollution you won't be able to see it anyway. So, not to mention light pollution. All the information about that is on here, and if you'd like to see it, I strongly recommend that you get yourself a set of road maps, and the sheet here recommends the Rand McNally Road Atlas, which is for sale in all the bookstores, and it's only $4. Bring them along with you. We will have marked copies of those maps on display, showing exactly where the central line of totality, which is what you're interested in, will be. And you can copy the data onto your own, and then you'll have all that information. Finally, we have another sheet here, another handout. Many of you are aware of the concept of space colonization, Gerard O'Neill and others. And in fact, I've given a lecture about that, not in this school year, toward the end of, in fact, just about a year ago now. Well, there is a citizens group called the L5 Society, which is interested in spaceflight in general and in space colonization in particular. L5 Society has a chapter here at the MSU campus, but in addition, there is the National Society, which puts out a truly excellent monthly newsletter. People are forever asking me, how do you keep up on what's going on in space? Well, one very fine answer is subscribe to the L5 News, become a member of the society. And if you're a student, you can do so for $15 a year. If you're not, it's $20 a year. I consider that worth it just for the L5 News, the newsletter. There are information sheets about the L5 Society up here, and there is a postage paid postcard that you can use to send off for more information to join whatever you may be interested in. Okay, let me now ask for the lights to be off and the first slide to be on. Start telling you about the Appalachians considered as an astronomical phenomenon. In other words, the whole point of including Earth lectures in a series of lectures about space is to put the Earth into perspective, look at it as a weird planet that it is, and consider how it differs from some of the others. You would not have anything like the Appalachians on any other planet. And the reason is the Appalachians started out, in fact, in detail in the particular structure that you see here, which is called a geosyncline. I hope there are no geologists in the audience who are upset by my use of the word geosyncline. The word is associated with a now discarded theory, and it was an idea, it was only a semi-theory because it never really gave much of an explanation for mountain building anyway, but it was the pre-plate tectonics notion, plate tectonics being what I talked about last time. There are some geologists who just don't like to use the word geosyncline, even though the phenomenon of the geosyncline itself exists. You know, it's just that different things happen to it, or we know a little bit more about what happens to it as a result of knowing about plate tectonics. So I'm going to use the term because I think it's a convenient word, but if any of you are upset about that, just substitute in your mind those particular sets of sedimentary rocks which lie off the edge of a continent during certain phases of plate tectonics, and hopefully we can remain friends. What is unusual about the Earth with respect to all the other planets is that, number one, only on this planet is there liquid water. I think you have had adequate demonstration of that tonight. I hope you appreciate this illustration that we were able to arrange with great difficulty to drive home to you. how incredible it is to have a planet where you have liquid water falling out of the sky in drops onto the ground. There's no other planet that we know of where that would happen. It is normal in the universe for water to be a gas, in fact, in most of it, or if it's not a gas, to be cold enough or have the pressure low enough or both, that water is a solid. As a result of having liquid water on the Earth, we have a surface such as no other planet, at least in the inner solar system, has. There are virtually no meteorite craters left from the first billion years or so of the solar system's history, as there are on all the other planets we know. There is an occasional crater forming even nowadays, but the great majority of them are older than 3.5 billion years, and the solar system is 4.5 billion years old. Instead, those ancient features have been, number one, destroyed by erosion due to liquid water, and even more importantly, number two, buried by rocks, sedimentary rocks, a phenomenon which is so common that geology is divided into two categories, the study of sedimentary rocks and everything else, soft rock geology and hard rock geology. And the soft rockers never talk to the hard rockers and vice versa. You know, it's almost as though they were different sciences. And 3/4 of the rocks exposed to the surface of the Earth are sedimentary rocks. You would not find that on any other planet. A sedimentary rock is a rock that has been has undergone the following history. Number one, some earlier rock, which may have been sedimentary or not, in many cases not, has been broken down into little pieces, sand grains, silt particles, pebbles, clay grains, whatever. And when I say broken down, the processes that do this are both physical and chemical. The physical ones simply make it smaller and round off the grains. The chemical ones change the actual composition of the grains and preferentially destroy some substances that rocks might be made of versus others. And so they change the composition of what's going to be left. And all of that happens as a result of there being liquid water here on the Earth. Water is such a tremendously powerful erosive agent that timescales of geologic destruction on the Earth are as short as the order of millions of years or even less, whereas on any other planet, you can see features that are billions of years in age. The moon gives an excellent illustration of that. There's not even wind erosion, let alone water erosion, since there is neither air nor water on the moon. And it's estimated that a typical footprint left on the moon by the astronauts, 1 inch deep, would remain visible for 20 million years before it was finally destroyed by the only kind of erosion that happens on the moon, and that is the very, very slow bombardment by the tiny meteorites, the little dust grain-sized micrometeorites, which on Earth burn up in the upper atmosphere, but on the moon come down and hit the surface. That's the only thing you've got on the moon. Well, consider how long a footprint would last on the Earth, and I think it would last until the next rain, basically, and I think you have a vivid, intuitive demonstration of what I'm talking about the importance of water. But although water destroys, water also creates. It can take these very sediments that it itself has created and carry them, sometimes for distances of thousands of miles, changing them as it goes, breaking them down, rubbing them against one another and making the pieces smaller and rubbing off corners, chemical changes happening along the way. Finally, it deposits them in some quiet area. Erosion is not only is erosion dominated by water on the Earth, but so is deposition. And so you have a thing like a sand beach, or you have clay and silt, which is mud. I mean, mud is actually a technical term, and what it means is particles that are smaller in size than sand, include some clay, lay down on the bottom of some relatively quiet body of water. Those are sediments, but then, if things change, if that pile of material is raised up, or the sea level lowers, or the water level, whatever it is, lowers, so that it now becomes dry, those sediments can be cemented together, again by substances left behind by water, percolating through them, dissolving material out of them, evaporating and leaving material behind, also leaving behind material that they carry from elsewhere. The commonest of those sediments is calcium carbonate. The commonest of those cements, rather, is calcium carbonate on the Earth. That's a substance whose significance you will appreciate fully only if you heard the Venus lecture, but suffice it to say, if you didn't, that it's the commonest cement on the Earth, and the second commonest is silica, which is to say the material of quartz is made out of silicon dioxide, so that what was simply a pile of loose dirt becomes this incredible phenomenon of sedimentary rock. The three commonest kinds of sedimentary rock are sandstone, which is sand cemented together by calcium carbonate or some other substance, shale, which is mud cemented together by one of those substances, and limestone, which is simply one of the cements itself, with very little material otherwise, and that can be deposited by any of a number of mechanisms which are not too terribly relevant here. Limestone is made of calcium carbonate, and there may be minor amounts of debris mixed in with a limestone, so you talk about a silty limestone or whatever. Those are the commonest kinds of sedimentary rocks. The difference between sand and silt and clay is size. Sand is a technical term in geology. It refers to sediment particles within a particular size range. Smaller than that is called silt, and still smaller than that is called clay. Larger than that, you get in other terms like cobbles, pebbles, cobbles, boulders, so forth and so on. Okay, here is an example of a place where sediments are being laid down and are slowly being cemented into sedimentary rock. This is the east coast of the United States. Particular parts have been shown, as you see, as Cape Hatteras off North Carolina. You have these relatively stagnant bays in there, protected by the sandbars, which have been laid down by water again. And on top of the edge of the granite block, which constitutes the North American continent, and which has an edge right there, and then that falls down, and there is a different kind of rock underneath here, which comes up to meet it, the floor of the oceans, or rather the rock that is under the sediments on the floor of the oceans, a heavier rock, the other major rock, other than the sedimentary ones in the Earth's crust, basalt. Well, on top of the edge of that granite continental block, you have laid down one on top of another, layer after layer, of sediments eroded off the Appalachians and other onshore regions. For the most part, it's the Appalachians. The Appalachians are being destroyed. They are very, very young by the standards of any other planet. Our modern Appalachians were formed 225 million years ago. They have ancestors that go back 375 million years ago. That is still only two-thirds of a billion years, whereas on the moon, the youngest rocks that were ever brought back from all of the Apollo missions were 3.2 billion years old. In other words, more than 10 times as far back in time, and those are the youngest of them all. The Appalachians, nevertheless, as a result of being on this incredible planet with this incredible liquid water that does this erosion, have been almost totally destroyed. Far more material has been eroded off them than is still left in them, and the rocks that we see today in the Appalachians, in many cases, are rocks that were many miles underground when the original mountains formed, and all that material has been stripped off them. In addition, you have rocks which are composed of sediments that were stripped off those very low-lying rocks to begin with as the erosion went on, and that were not carried all the way to the ocean, that are still there in the region of the Appalachians and have been incorporated into the mountains that we see today. This particular structure that we've got here at the edge of a continental shelf is what is called a geosyncline. It has two portions to it. First of all, there is layer on top of layer on top of layer of sediments, and these layers are relatively undisturbed. Once you get down in the bottom of the ocean, there is not a whole lot that goes on to disturb gunk that may be laid down there. Gunk is an alternative term for sediment. That may be laid down there. You will note that the various strata are not perfectly perpendicular to one another. They get thicker as you go out towards the edge. And the reason for that is that under the weight of this increasing amount of sediment, the edge of the continent is very, very slowly sinking downward. And so the direction of the horizontal keeps changing, and it changes in such a direction that they wedge out, they get thicker towards the edge. And then all of a sudden you hit the edge of these piles of sediments, and I think you can imagine that's going to be an unstable place. Every once in a while, there is going to be a situation where sediment has piled up to the point where the underlying material can't support its own weight, and suddenly a chunk of the stuff breaks off and goes thundering down maybe 2 miles down. Well, thundering is not the word underwater. Goes avalanching down 2 miles, forming something that's called a turbidity current, almost the only violent event that ever happens in the deep ocean bottoms. And thundering is what it would do if there were air there instead of water to carry the sound. Turbidity currents can move at hundreds of miles an hour, and every once in a while one of them breaks undersea cables or something like that. So a good deal of study has been done about them. When the turbidity currents fall off this edge, they fall down into what initially was the slot, the edge, the wedge, whatever you want to call it, where the basalt is coming down and meeting the very edge of the granite continental block. For reasons that I will show you in a moment, that basalt on the floor of the ocean, underneath the sediments on the ocean, on the floor of the ocean, that basalt is not horizontal. It gets deeper and deeper as you go towards the edge of the continent, and the very deepest part of it is right off the edge of the continent. For those of you who were here last time, I am not talking about the deep ocean trenches which are caused by subduction. This is a different phenomenon. We're participating in these turbidity currents as they fall off the edge of the shelf. And so you have two parallel strips of sediment off the edge of the continent. You have overlying the edge of the granitic block this relatively thin, relatively undisturbed pile of relatively well-defined strata. And then you have off the edge of the granitic block, over the very closest part of the basaltic portion, you have this much thicker prism of highly distorted sediments. That strip, those two parallel strips of sediments, are collectively referred to as a geosyncline. The origin of that word, well, never mind, that's another issue. The two parts of it have their own separate names. The continental shelf sediments are referred to as the myogeosyncline. Myo is a prefix, Greek prefix meaning almost. And the really thick part, the disordered part, is referred to as the eugeosyncline, EU being a Greek prefix meaning true or genuine, well is the actual literal translation. So you got the myogeosyncline and you got the eugeosyncline, both of them forming off the east coast of the United States today. Those two structures someday will turn into another mountain range. And similar structures in the past are what have given birth to today's mountain range, the Appalachians, and other mountain ranges at the same place, the edge of the continent, roughly the same place. It's not exactly the edge because the edge is not always exactly the same place, so it's not always the modern edge that we've got today. But it is from this kind of structure that our mountain ranges form. The significance of that is that none of this would happen. The sediments themselves would not be there, and they certainly would not act in the way that they do and form the structures that they do if you did not have the remarkable phenomenon of a planet whose surface geology is dominated by liquid water. You've got to understand that when you look at another planet, such as Venus, which is the same size as the Earth, may very well be the same kind of body as the Earth, but does not have liquid water on its surface. In the first place, Venus seems to be missing water as a substance. It seems to have very much less of the stuff per cubic mile than the Earth does. But in the second place, such water as Venus has must be a gas, because the surface temperature of Venus is 900 degrees Fahrenheit, far above the boiling point of water. And so if you look at Venus and you say, well, how similar is this to the Earth? Simply looking at it and naively saying, there aren't any mountain ranges like the Appalachians, if indeed that turns out to be the case, and we just don't know very much about what kind of surface features Venus has now. We will learn some of that from the Pioneer Venus Orbiter, which has a rather crude radar mapper on board, but better than nothing. But if we look at those radar images and say there's nothing like the Appalachians, therefore Venus does not have plate tectonics, which is the dominant feature that generates these mountain ranges out of the sediments on the Earth, that would be a very naive kind of statement to make. We don't expect the same kind of mountain ranges. You don't have the same substances to make them of, and you're not going to have the same structures to form into them. And I mention this because I have heard planetary geologists, general geologists, planetary astronomers, let's say, who ought to know better, make statements of exactly that sort. And they're simply demonstrating the fact that, unfortunately, most astronomers don't know very much about the Earth, and most Earth geologists don't know very much about the other planets. And that's the purpose of a lecture something like this one. Now, the reason that the basalt falls off in depth as you move away from the center of the Atlantic Ocean towards the edge of the continent is that that basalt is being generated coming as material, molten material, coming up from inside the Earth along the mid-Atlantic ridge. And then slowly, the newly generated basalt is thrust aside to make room for more basalt, still newer basalt that is coming up from underneath. If you plot the ages of the rocks on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, you find that they go in stripes, and they get older and older and older as you get away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, until the very oldest rocks are those that are lying just off the edge of the continent. The edge of the continent, the edge of the granitic block, I mean, the continental shelf, is shown on the map by this line of hatchers here. And so what I'm saying is that as the basalt is generated there, it is the youngest, and then it moves farther and farther away, and the oldest basalt, which is 200 million years old, lies just off the continental shelf.
200 million years is a very short age, as ages go in the solar system in general, but that is a typical oldest age for rocks on the bottoms of the ocean. All of our present ocean bottom rocks are quite young geologically, young even compared to some of the continental rocks, which get up into the billions of years in places. Does that mean that there were never any oceans or rocks to floor them before 200 million years ago? Of course not, but it means that the rocks which existed then on the bottoms of the oceans that existed then have now been totally destroyed and have been replaced with these present ones that we see today. Well, as the new basalt comes up out of the inside of the Earth, it is hot. And as a result of being hot, it takes up more space than it would if it cooled off. Therefore, the place where it comes out is not just a crack, it is a ridge. It is a mid-ocean ridge. And that ridge contains a volume fully comparable to the amount of material that is present in the major mountain ranges on land. For example, all of the mountain ranges in Western North America combined occupy a volume sticking up into the air about as great as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge occupies sticking up into the water, simply because that newly born basalt is hot. As the basalt moves slowly away from the place where it forms, it cools. And as it cools, it becomes denser and therefore occupies less space and therefore sinks down. As a result, you've got that wedge-shaped space off the edge of the continental shelf for the turbidity current sediments to fall into and form the great eugeosynclinal prism. Here is a picture of what you have just seen, but with one major difference. This top picture, which shows the way the two continents are today, North America on the one side, Africa on the other side, moving slowly apart so the Atlantic Ocean is getting wider and wider. It is about 2 inches wider this year than it was last year, or at least that's the correct number, if that moving apart goes at a steady rate. We don't know that. We're hoping to find that out within a few years from observations of all things, laser reflectors left on the moon during the Apollo project. That's another story for another time. But this is the same kind of feature that you're seeing there, that I was talking about there, with one very important exception. This is an earlier Atlantic Ocean, which no longer exists. And that top picture illustrates the situation. It illustrates the situation as it is today, but the picture was drawn to illustrate the situation 800 million years ago. If you were not here last time, I have to tell you that 200 million years ago, almost all of the continents of the Earth, the granitic blocks in the crust of the Earth, were together in one giant supercontinent, which is called Pangaea, which means all Earth. In particular, the east coast of North America was lying along what is now the northwestern coast of Africa. 200 million years ago, Pangaea split down the middle. And that split was what was to become the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The two pieces moved apart, driven apart by whatever the processes are that cause plate tectonics, which you do not understand, new basalt developing the space in between, and the Atlantic Ocean, which at first was a narrow slot in the middle of this riven supercontinent, and has been getting wider and wider, and still getting wider and wider ever since, the Atlantic Ocean began to be created as soon as the water as soon as the trench was deep enough, the water was able to come in and fill it in. That was not the whole story, however. Pangaea itself had been formed by the coming together of earlier continents, roughly but not exactly identical in outline to the present-day North America, South America, Europe, and Africa. And that had happened 375 million years ago. 375 million years ago, there was a single continent. Before that, you had an Atlantic Ocean, but an Atlantic Ocean that was closing. And that Atlantic Ocean had been closing ever since 500 million years ago. Before that, however, you had the same kind of situation as you have today, that is to say, an Atlantic Ocean with an older Mid-Atlantic Ridge in the middle of it, which was moving the two continents apart. So what you have had is the rather incredible statement that the continents, 800 million years ago, you had an earlier Pangaea. That earlier Pangaea split apart, moved out so the pieces were a certain maximum distance apart, and you had the first Atlantic Ocean. Then that motion ceased, the motion turned around, they came together, collided to form our Pangaea, the most recent one, 375 million years ago, remained stuck together for almost 200 million years, and split apart again 200 million years ago. So what you're seeing in that top picture is just after the breaking apart of the earlier Pangaea. I'm not going to say the first, because for all we know, this has been happening many, many times. The earlier Pangaea that existed 800 million years ago. Here you see a situation, oh, say 550 million years ago, anytime during the Cambrian, and you will note that off the edges of the two continents, we have a Miogeosyncline and a Eugeosyncline for the reasons that I was just talking about the present one that is happening, that is forming today. Then, a very dramatic thing happened somewhere around 450 million years ago. The edge, let's go back to that last slide for a moment. Right about there, the edge split off. This basaltic material broke. And one piece of the basaltic material began being forced down under the other, so that the ocean began to close as Africa and North America on the eastern side were, Africa and Europe on the eastern side were driven towards North America on the western side. As a result of that closing, the land crumpled up. And you also got one of the deep sea trenches, which I told you not to confuse with the prism that is filled with the Miogeosynclinal sediments. Why is this trench not being filled with sediments? Because as soon as sediments get eroded off the newly formed mountains on shore, they fall down to the bottom all right, but they get caught up in the bottom and they get driven down underneath the edge of the continent. They do not pile up as the geosynclinal sediments, which you get in an opening ocean, are able to do. Very different kind of structure at a very different kind of boundary if the ocean is closing than if the ocean is opening. Well, the result of this material being driven down underneath the edge of the continent is that some of it melted, and as a result of that melting, in addition, those geosynclinal sediments were being crumpled. And they were being crumpled in different ways because, remember, they had different structures. The eugeosynclinal sediments, which were highly disturbed, very, very deep, and closest to the edge where the crumpling was going on, got the greatest amount of distortion. They were disturbed to begin with as a result of having been mixed together so much by the mechanism that formed them. Now they are being disturbed even more as a result of being on the fighting edge where the action is happening. And so those sediments, and besides, that was the thicker of the two strips that make up the geosyncline, and so if they're going to get crumpled, the crumpling is more severe just because there's more material that has to be moved before you can crumple. And so that material got so severely distorted that to a first approximation, we can say it all got merged into the same stuff. It's all roughly the same kind of rock. Actually, in detail, of course, that's not true, but to a first approximation, it is. Further, and into that primarily, was injected the granite. Further inland, you had less severe crumpling, and therefore a crumpling which left more order in the rock, of the eugeosynclinal sediments, which were more ordered to begin with. And so what you're going to have is a severely distorted but more or less uniform belt along the outer edge, and a belt of highly crumpled strata in which, nevertheless, the individual strata are still pretty much recognizable further inland, and then here and there, injected into the whole thing to complicate the issue, the pods of granite. 375 million years ago, the climax occurred when the two continents actually came together. They collided. They remained stuck together for almost 200 million years, from 375 million years ago to 200 million years ago. During that period, however, the mountains that had been formed as a result of this crumpling of the original pre-collision and collision phases, and of course, as you can imagine, when the two geosynclines were jammed together, you had even more severe distortion of the rocks. Those mountains were very quickly destroyed, leveled, brought down essentially to sea level, by the remarkable phenomenon of liquid water erosion. Those are not the present-day Appalachians. However, it is their roots which are now revealed up into the air as a result of the subsequent erosion that make up the present-day Appalachians, and so the structure that you see here is still there. Those mountains were destroyed, and for most of that nearly 200 million year period when you had the continents together, when you had Pangaea, this was pretty much flat country.
225 million years ago, however, a mere 25 million years before the continents finally moved apart again, a very strange and dramatic thing happened, which we don't understand. And that is, the eastern continents, Europe and Africa, made a final attempt to move westward. They weren't able to, because the American continents were there blocking their advance. But they tried again. Something started pushing them again. And they, you can think of it as they sort of lowered their heads and made one last desperate charge. Well, they didn't get anywhere, but the land in the middle was crumpled up once again. And so you had the creation of a mountain range by plate tectonics process in a place where you don't ordinarily expect to find a mountain range being created, right smack down the middle of a single continent. After that happened, that is the formation of the Appalachians 225 million years ago. After that happened, the forces reversed. Pangaea split, not quite down the middle, but to the east of the mountain range that had been produced from this structure here as a result of the recrumpling. And so you do not see another corresponding range of mountains along the western coast of Africa. We picked up the material from Africa. Florida is an example of a block of matter that we picked up that had been Africa before Pangaea formed. On the other hand, we gave some material to the other side. We ended up with more than they did, but there was an exchange in both directions. Scotland had been part of New England up until the time they split apart. Kind of interesting that Old England, or at least Old Britain, got a part of New England, as it was to be named, 200 million years later. Well, when they split apart then, we got all the mountainous material, and so, well, we got virtually all of it, and so here is the situation after 200 million years ago. The stresses had now reversed themselves. You were trying to push the continents together, now all of a sudden everything reverses and the continents are being pulled apart. And that has some important local ramifications, which I'm going to go into because I happen to have some especially nice slides of them later on, so bear that in mind. What I'm talking about is the creation of the Triassic lowlands or Triassic grabens that you have all down the eastern United States. And here is the situation that you have today with the Atlantic still moving, still getting wider, the two continents still moving apart, and since this is a quiet edge with no subduction to carry away the sediments, once again we are having a eugeosyncline and a miogeosyncline and a eugeosyncline formed from the sediments coming off the continents. As those of you who were here last time at the end will remember, I have oversimplified this picture. For one thing, the Appalachians, after they formed, got eroded completely down to sea level. Then there was further uplift of the land, which included not only the mountains themselves, but some of the previously undisturbed strata, which consisted of sediments laid down in shallow seas while after the original Appalachians had been formed. Sediments eroded off those Appalachians. This material got lifted up into the air too, and then that got eroded a good part of the way down to sea level. There was renewed uplift, and we are now in the stage with this third set of uplift from the second set of mountains generated along the eastern, what is now the eastern United States, that third set of mountains in the process of being eroded down to sea level. And so I think you can see it's a ferociously complicated history in detail. But if you understand the structure that I just talked about, then you can understand why the Appalachians consist of what they do today. Here is the structure of the Appalachians that we see today. Included in this are some regions where the people who live there do not consider themselves as living in the mountains. But in fact, if you look at the underlying structure of the land, they are part of the Appalachians, they just happen to be part of the Appalachians, which are not, quote, mountainous, that is, up and down kind of terrain. It also includes a wide belt of material that never was part of the Appalachians. It is the continental sediments, the materials lay down in those shallow seas to the west of the original Appalachians, that got caught up in the most recent of the uplifts. So the structure of what we call the Appalachian structure is not identical to what the people who live there call the Appalachian mountains. The Appalachians consist of a series of parallel strips reflecting those two parallel strips that were in the original geosyncline that was to become them. And those parallel strips run roughly north-south along the eastern United States. there are places where this structure is developed more typically than others, and the place where you see it the very best is right through about southern Pennsylvania down to Virginia, and that's what's been shown here. You get farther north into New England and farther south into, say, Georgia, and you don't necessarily have all the structure, or you have modifications of it. So let me show you what the, quote, typical structure is in Virginia and Pennsylvania is first, and then come back to those other areas later. The first thing that you see, of course, is the is something that is not part of the mountains at all. The first thing that you see as you go from the east to the west, and that is the sediments, some of which are above water and are called the coastal plain, some of which are below water and are called the continental shelf. But it's all the same stuff. The most recent, the currently building myogeosyncline, which is overlying the granitic rocks that are at the edge of the continent. Where those granitic rocks first come and other rocks that started out life as the eugeosynclinal sediments come to the surface, you have a belt which is higher than the coastal plain because it is tougher to erode. You've got to understand that the current structure of the Appalachian is determined not so much by this underlying structure beneath the earth. That's what determines it ultimately. But what determines whether you see a ridge or a valley, a height or a lowland in a given place, is whether the highest rocks that happen to be nearest the surface at that particular place are high in resistance to erosion or are low in resistance to erosion. The Piedmont rocks, which are the eugeosynclinal sediments reaching the surface above the current coastal plain, are relatively resistant to erosion. Therefore, it's a relatively high region, but remember that those rocks were largely homogenized. Therefore, it has largely the same height all the way along. And when you're in the Piedmont, you don't get the impression of being in mountainous country. Philadelphia is right at the edge of the Piedmont. So, in fact, is New York City, so is Trenton, New Jersey, so is Wilmington, Delaware, so is Washington, D.C., and Baltimore, Maryland. That is not by accident, and I will tell you in a little while why those cities are where they are. If you understand this geologic history, you can understand the map of the eastern United States, including where the cities are, not just where the mountains and lowlands are. I come from Philadelphia. I was born there. And I can guarantee that the people who live in Philadelphia, which would be right there, do not think of themselves as living at the edge of the Appalachian Mountains. If you ask them where the mountains begin, they'll tell you further inland. What they will tell you, in fact, is where the Blue Ridge begins, and that's the next of that parallel strip. Actually, it's what geologists call the Blue Ridge Province. Not all of it is named Blue Ridge by the people who live there. In fact, there are portions of other provinces which locally are named Blue Ridge. Blue Ridge or Blue Mountain or Blue Hill or whatever is a very common name for mountains all over the United States because of the phenomenon of Rayleigh scattering in the atmosphere which causes our blue sky. Very often, the first view that anybody has who first moves into a given area of a mountain range is when it's distant and therefore appears blue. But the Blue Ridge Province is the parallel strip which runs along just interior to the Piedmont. It includes the highest peaks in the Appalachian Mountains, and it's a detail. It's a place where some of that granitic material that in many places has not made it all the way to the surface, in this place has, as a result of faulting and as a result of this granite being shoved up above the rest of its Piedmont neighbors. And so you have that Blue Ridge strip as a sort of extra added detail to the general kind of structure that I'm trying to show you about. Question here.
Yes. In this diagram, where would be the location of Carolina Bays?
So the Carolina Bays are on the Piedmont.
They are on the Piedmont.
And I'm sorry, they're not. They're on the coastal plain. They do not get over into the Piedmont, which is what's the matter with the meteorite theory of their origin. Okay, I'm sure everybody else doesn't know what we're talking about, but it's a geologic structure that occurs in, in fact, you can trace it all the way up to New Jersey, but it's best developed in the Carolinas, called the Carolina Bays. Then, this is the edge of the eugeosynclinal material. Now you get into the myogeosynclinal material, which is the relatively undisturbed sedimentary strata that originally had been laid down in the relatively shallow water overlying the top of the continent, not overlying the basalt, as the eugeosynclinal material was. And so that has gotten crumpled. And what it's gotten crumpled into, as you can imagine, is just what you would get by taking a rug and moving one edge of it towards the other, so you get a series of ridges and valleys. And that is referred to, with typical scientific poetry, as the ridge and valley province of the Appalachians. there is one major valley, one especially big one, which happens to be just to the west of the Blue Ridge, and which runs all the way down from the northern boundary of the United States, in fact, beyond. It's where Lake Champlain is. It's the Hudson Valley is part of it. Shenandoah Valley is part of it. Runs 1,500 miles down the eastern United States, almost without a break. And it is called the Great Valley. As you can imagine, it was a major highway during the westward expansion. And all sorts of details about how that expansion proceeded are to be explained by where there happened to be local obstructions within the Great Valley. That, for example, is why Kentucky was settled before Michigan, before the northern states, before the states that were north of Kentucky were. It was easier to get into Kentucky from the east. And so what happened was they got into Kentucky, and then Kentuckians moved north and settled Michigan, and first Ohio and then Michigan. The Great Valley, it had slightly different profiles, might very well have been the other way around. To the west of the Great Valley is the rest of the Ridge and Valley province, and then you run out of your myogeosynclinal sediments, and you get into a belt, which, although it is not strictly speaking part of the Appalachian structure, can hardly be ignored. It is half of this total width in most cross-sections of the Appalachians, and in many places it actually includes the highest peaks. That is the continental sediments that have been laid down in the shallow seas that had never been part of a geosyncline, which happened to get included in the most recent regional uplift. And those regions of undisturbed, flat-lying strata are referred to as the Allegheny Plateaus. Allegheny Plateaus in the north, Cumberland Plateaus in the south, the general name for all of them is the Appalachian Plateaus. Now, if any of you have been there, you are probably startled to hear somebody describe them as plateaus, to hear somebody talk about them as undisturbed, still flat-lying strata, because if you hike over them, their surface is anything but flat-lying. The reason for that is that a plateau does not mean what most people think that it means. That is to say, an elevated region that is perfectly flat and smooth on its surface. As a result of this incredible phenomenon of liquid water erosion on the Earth, there are no large elevated regions with perfectly flat, smooth surfaces. As soon as you uplift a given region by any mechanism, crumbling due to plate tectonics or simply this general regional uplift, no matter what causes it, the erosion, which was gentle as long as it was near sea level and the creeks and rivers didn't have much force, suddenly becomes much more powerful. The rivers eat down into it, eat away its material, and carry that material away so that you have what started out as erosion gullies, before that I suppose creek beds, becoming major canyons, and then becoming widespread valleys in between what look like mountain peaks, but are in fact simply the tiny remnants, what is left of what would have been the flat, smooth plateau surface if there had been no erosion. What would indeed have been the flat, smooth plateau surface if this were any planet other than the Earth. So the Appalachian Plateaus, so-called, are not part of the Appalachians, but they are nevertheless high, and they seem mountainous in structure. How do you tell the difference? Go to the Ridge and Valley province and look at the road cuts, and you will find the strata are distorted. Go to the Appalachian Plateaus and look at the road cuts, and you will find the strata are flat right up to the edge of the, quote, mountain, end quote, where the whole pile of strata simply cut off. That's the difference. As I mentioned last time, this sort of thing happens outside the Appalachians as well. The so-called Ozark Mountains are not mountains either. They, too, are a highly eroded plateau. Dissected is the geologic term for this kind of erosion which has eaten away a large part of a plateau and left what seems to be mountains and valleys. The Ozarks are a highly dissected plateau which was also caused by regional uplift of a different part of the country at a different time for different reasons, presumably. We don't know what caused this regional uplift, so it's really hard to say very much about, you know, whether the causes were different one place or another. And you see this kind of thing all over. All right, enter Skylab. Enter, in fact, I think one of the most magnificent pictures to have come out of Skylab. Skylab was launched 5 years ago this coming Saturday, so I hope you're all planning a party 2 days from now to celebrate the 5th anniversary. Skylab had initial problems at its launch, which were very dramatically solved by the astronauts and the first crew.
They performed relatively simple repairs, which nevertheless could never have been done if Skylab had been an unmanned mission, and thereby produced the most dramatic illustration to date of the value of having human beings in space, rather than, as Arthur C. Clarke puts it, some people seem to think that all the exploration should be done by robots and man should stay home and watch television as God intended. The robots, when they get themselves into trouble, usually can't haul themselves out of it. And so I prefer even more a quotation from Jerry O'Neill, who said, "We all love R2-D2, but it's time we stop letting him have all the fun." In the case of Skylab, the astronauts went up there, made idiotically simple repairs, in some cases, which literally consisted of nothing more than hitting a malfunctioning device with a hammer, but repairs, and most of them were a little bit more sophisticated than that, but still, very, very simple repairs, things that anybody could have done, but that you can't imagine someone having had the foresight to design a machine to have done. You know, if they'd had that much foresight, then the problem never would have happened in the first place. And Skylab went on to become the most successful space mission ever flown by anybody for anything, Russian or American, manned or unmanned. It's estimated that the oil and minerals alone discovered by Skylab are enough to pay for the entire U.S. space program from its beginning in 1958 through the present, and that's something of the order of $50 billion. The way you discover oil and minerals from 270 miles up is not, of course, to look for the substances themselves, but to look for the geologic structures that indicate their presence. And I think you get some hint from this magnificent picture, and this is by no means the most detailed you've got. I deliberately picked one that shows a wide angle so you could start out with the broad view. And you can see that is practically a geologic map of the entire country down there, with different kinds of rock showing up as different colors. And I'll tell you in a moment some of the reasons why that happens. You look for those structures, and then you send your field geologist out to check and see if indeed there's oil there, or there's copper there, or there's uranium there, all three of which, and many more, have been discovered from Skylab pictures, and in many cases it turns out that there is. And that's what exploratory geology is all about. Increasing the odds that when you go and look, you'll find it, so you don't waste all your money in going and looking. You still can waste some money in going and looking. The idea is to minimize that. Skylab also revolutionized our knowledge of the sun, and you can hear some things about that if you come to Ann Arbor tomorrow, and it taught us a great deal about how human beings can adapt to space conditions, particularly weightlessness, and incredibly enough, it turns out we can adapt to them very, very well. That is a remarkable statement, considering we're the product of something like 4 billion years of evolution in a 1G environment here on the Earth. But remarkably enough, it turns out that apparently we can stand weightlessness indefinitely, provided we take some relatively simple precautions. I wanted to say a little, by way of paying tribute to Skylab, first because the 5th anniversary is coming up, and maybe now you do feel there's reason for a party. After all, it doesn't take much excuse to have a party, right? But secondly, because there has been so much publicity recently about the fact that Skylab may have become a hazard rather than an asset, and I'd like you to know that it has also been an asset. Needless to say, the publicity doesn't usually mention that. Skylab was abandoned by its final crew, its mission completed. In fact, far more than completed. They got about 300% of what the most optimistic pre-mission forecast had suggested they might be able to accomplish. It was then abandoned by its final crew, not abandoned in the sense they didn't care about it anymore, left behind in 1973, and it's still up there, but very, very slowly, air friction has been bringing it back closer and closer to the Earth. And that's a cumulative process. The closer you get to the Earth, the denser the air becomes, and therefore the more air friction there is. And so sometime during the next year to 18 months, Skylab, if nothing is done about it, will re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. That probably is nothing hazardous, although it is believed some portions of it will not burn up completely, will survive to hit the surface. But I remind you that in the first place, 3/4 of the Earth's surface is covered by water. In the second place, 9/10 of the land, even today, is uninhabited. And in the third place, even in the inhabited areas, the chances are pretty good that a human being would not get hit just because human beings are pretty small targets. You know, if a chunk weighs 5 tons lands in your backyard, it may create a big hole, but if it doesn't hit you, it at least hasn't done you any harm. You know, and you call NASA and you say, come get this thing or I'm going to keep it myself. If somebody comes up with a target prediction for where Skylab is going to hit, if someone else is willing to pay my airfare, I will cheerfully go and stand there and dare it to do its worst, because
if I'm allowed to carry my camera, because the re-entry of Skylab is going to be one of the most spectacular celestial events that anybody has ever seen, and I would love to be right where it's coming towards. However, I would love even more to see it never happen. Skylab, wonderful though it was at the time, and wonderful though the things that we got from it were already, still represents an investment of $2.5 billion, which it seems like a shame to throw away. That works out, by the way, to $1.56 per year for the average U.S. citizen. Less than it sounds like. But still, a major investment and a major resource up there. It could be used for a number of things during the shuttle era, a thing that it was never designed for, but turns out it's possible. It's even conceivable they could fill it with air again and actually use it as a space station again. And there are studies that are going on right now to see about that. So because of the slight hazard and because of the very real fact that it would be a shame to lose such a resource, one of the very highest priority missions for one of the very highest priority objectives for a very early shuttle mission is to try to save Skylab, to go up to it possibly as early as the second shuttle flight next year, fasten to it a small rocket unit, and fire that rocket unit to send it up into a higher orbit, so that it would not decay again for another 10 or 20 years, during which time we'll have acquired much more experience with the shuttle and be able to go up and actually do something with it. The idea right now is just to try to save it. That's probably what they would do. The alternative idea is to deliberately fire the rocket to send it downward into the atmosphere and make it burn up, and make it burn up at a controlled, previously known location. As it is now, there's no way to predict, except perhaps a few days in advance, exactly where it would come down. Okay, so much for the digression about Skylab. Let's get back to the structure of the Appalachians. I think that you have recognized, as you've been staring at this picture, that the entire state of New Jersey, with the exception of the southern tip of Cape May, is shown there. Whole state of Delaware. There is Chesapeake Bay. Washington and Baltimore are down there, although you notice this resolution, there is no sign of intelligent life. Philadelphia would be right there. New York City is there. And the Appalachians, in all of their glory, spread out across this scene, which was taken in May of 5 years ago, all of that structure spread out, visible for the structures to be seen. First of all, here is the coastal plain. This is the edge of the coastal plain right there. This line, you can see the line very clearly. It goes out to sea at New York City. It is called the fall line. The reason it is called the fall line is this. All along it, the rivers run across the relatively high, relatively flat rocks of the Piedmont, and then suddenly plunge over the edge to the lower, soft sediments of the coastal plain. In fact, the coastal plain sediments are so soft that many of them to this day have not even been turned into rock. I spent a lot of my childhood in southern New Jersey, right there at Millville, and that is all sand. There's no rock. It's just loose sand. In fact, it's a major glass-producing area of the country for just that reason. These coastal plain sediments are softer and therefore lower than the Piedmont. And so every time a river goes over the edge, you have a set of waterfalls. When I say the edge, well, at the scale of this picture, it's a line. When you get down and look at it at a human scale, you find, in fact, the so-called fall line is a zone, typically a few miles wide. And so instead of a single dramatic Niagara-type waterfall, you generally have a series of rapids. But you do have them. The falls of the Delaware just above Trenton, the falls of the Schuylkill at Philadelphia, the falls of the Potomac where there's a park at, that's the Susquehanna, falls of the Susquehanna as well, falls of the Potomac where there's a park just upstream from Washington, D.C., and so on down, and a whole series of smaller ones that you would be less likely to have heard of. You will notice also that the cities, all of the cities of any size in the eastern United States are built along the fall line and nowhere else. New York City, Trenton, Philadelphia, Wilmington, Baltimore and Washington, further south, cities in North Carolina and Virginia and so forth. And in fact, there is only one major city that is actually in the Piedmont, and there are no major cities that are actually in the Blue Ridge or Ridge and Valley province. The one major city that is in the Piedmont is Atlanta, Georgia, which is so far south that the reasons that I'm about to tell you about were no longer significant. Consider where, if you were a person in the 1700s who had just come with relatively simple technology to this untamed continent, where you are going to build a city, or as you would have thought of it, a town. William Penn, who founded Philadelphia, referred to it as a green country town. It's not the way it looks now, but apparently it's the way it was then.
Where are you going to build yourself a major tower? Well, you're going to build it next to a waterfall. Not for hydroelectric power in those days, but to drive sawmills, flour mills, that sort of thing. On the other hand, you want it to be a seaport. Now, the obvious place, if you're going to have a seaport, would be to build it on the coast. But then you don't have those falls. There are no waterfalls in the coastal plain. The rocks are too soft and therefore too easily eroded. And you've got to understand that a waterfall is a geologically short-lived phenomenon. A waterfall is a place where the water is moving faster than it is anywhere else. And the faster water moves, the more rapidly the materials that it carries in it are able to erode. Therefore, waterfalls are preferentially destroyed, and there is a tendency, as a given water course evolves, as it ages, for the gradient, the slope, to become level, at least over a given small area. When you change from one rock type to another, then things may become more complicated. So waterfalls are short-lived features. The main reason we have most of the waterfalls that exist in the United States today is that there was a very, very recent phenomenon which led up only about 10,000 years ago, more like 15,000 where we are here, and of course that's just yesterday geologically, and that so totally disturbed the rivers, the drainage system of the northern part of the United States, that it has not yet had a chance to become mature. I'm referring, of course, to the most recent glaciation. When those glaciers retreated, they left behind trillions of tons of debris which filled in the valleys of most of the old rivers that had been there, but there were new rivers that were created on top of the new surface, and in many, many places those new rivers, which were young, which had not yet adjusted themselves to the geologic conditions of their terrain, ate down through the glacial debris, which in some places was thin, hit bedrock, and there you have a set of waterfalls. If you make a map of the places in the United States which have the word falls or the word mills in their name, or map the places that you just happen to know from a study of history, and geographers have gone into this in some detail, that were cited where they are as a result of having waterfalls, that map is virtually a map of the glaciated areas of the United States. The major exception to that, the only place where you really have a lot of waterfalls for reasons other than glaciation, is the fall line. And so a good place to build your seaport, a good place to build your city would be where it's a seaport, but another good place to build it would be where there are falls, and there were one set of places where you could have both. Where were those? Well, during the most recent glaciation and the others that preceded it, sea level fell by something of the order of 200 to 300 feet. Now, if you think about it for a second, you'll realize that no river can erode its valley below sea level. Okay? The water cannot go down and then back up. And so the lowest that a valley can be is sea level. But if sea level falls, then the river can erode down to a lower depth. And if the river is choked with glacial meltwater, it will be able to erode very efficiently to a lower depth. The depth that rivers such as the Delaware and the Susquehanna and the Potomac were able to erode during the low periods of sea level in the ice ages were such that they were able to eat down through a great deal of the soft rocks of the coastal plain, but not a great deal of the hard rocks of the Piedmont on the other side of the fall line. And so what you have is narrow valleys in each of those major rivers in the east coast of the United States until you hit the fall line, and then wide, deep valleys across the coastal plain and across what is now the continental shelf. Then the glaciers melt, sea level rises again, and each one of those valleys becomes flooded, forming the bays, which are the characteristic feature of the map of the east coast of the United States. You have Delaware Bay, which is the drowned mouth of the Delaware. You have Chesapeake Bay, which is the drowned mouth of the Susquehanna. You have the estuary of the Potomac. You have the bays that we saw in that first slide in North Carolina, and so on and so forth, all the way south until you get to the place where the coastal plain is so wide, that is to say, the majority of it is above sea level, and so you have a wide coastal plain and only a narrow offshore continental shelf, that the bays simply did not extend that far inland. And that's the reason why Atlanta is the only major city in the Appalachian region of the country which was not cited as a result of the consideration of being on the fall line. What's the importance of being in those bays? Well, the bays give you a nice wide harbor. And so you build yourself a harbor.